The views expressed in the following program are those of the writers and producers and do not necessarily reflect the views of KORC, its underwriters, or community airwaves.
People ride bicycles for many different reasons. They're a highly practical and cost-effective form of transportation for people who may choose not to or may not be able to drive a car. Cyclists are legally legitimate road users. They also improve public health and reduce traffic and parking load. Cyclists and motorists share many rights and responsibilities. However, cyclists are less conspicuous, slower, and more vulnerable in a crash, so extra care must be taken to keep your fellow humans safe. Be alert and aware at all times. Situational awareness is of paramount importance. Put your phone away where you can't hear it or feel it. Use your turn signals and maneuver predictably. Look where you want to go, not where you don't want to go. When parallel parking, check your side mirror for bicyclists before opening your door. When turning or changing lanes, check twice for other road users. Don't be in a hurry. Leave earlier for your appointments. Ultimately, driving a car is a big, adulty responsibility. Don't screw it up. You're listening to KORC, Community Radio for Corvallis.
You're listening to KORC News, Music, and Civics. I'm Trevor Sayre. On Tuesday, November 26th at 4:30 p.m., the Climate Action Advisory Board meeting will be held in person at the Madison Avenue Meeting Room, 500 Southwest Madison Avenue. The meeting will also be held virtually. See CorvallisOregon.gov for details on how to join the meeting online. For KORC News, Music, and Civics, I'm Trevor Sayre.
Hello, listeners. This is Wendy Byrne for KORC's News, Music, and Civics. Where do I start today? It was, literally and figuratively, a stormy week here in Corvallis. And while the bomb cyclone weather pattern might have passed us by, a bomb cyclone budget pattern might be upon us come July of 2025 if the City Council continues to move forward with the current plans for a new civic campus. We will talk about that and more today at this week's Corvallis Civics Cafe. The menu for today is stew, and I have been stewing all week, so let's go. Last week, I ended my program with this. If you have concerns about the Civic Campus, the City Hall, the process, and the budget, acting sooner is better than later. Write City Council before they meet on December 2nd. Contact information can be found at CorvallisOregon.gov. Today, I'd like to pick up where I left off. On Monday night at the City Council meeting, the mayor derided the misinformed public. He stated that he and the council received letters and comments from some people about their unhappiness with the project, and scolded the public for inaccuracies in their letters. He reminded us that there has been nothing sudden about the process. The overall process, the one dealing with the entirety of city facilities, has indeed been underway for 4 years. But most recently, we have been talking about if and how to replace our city hall and our police facility. Many people in the community had no idea that this discussion was underway, and those who do know something about it have few of the details. If the public outreach has not worked, how can that be fixed? Complaining about it at their meetings and chiding people for errors is petty and does little to close the information gap. Perhaps this is a good place for a short history on the big picture of this project. A search through the city documents reveals that as early as mid-2021, FFA architecture firm has been working with the city on this process. They, along with Special Project Manager Mary Steckel, who was formerly our Director of Public Works, produced a report documenting the deficiencies of each and every city-owned facility. This citywide facilities strategy is a formal report that you can see on the city website, and it was adopted by the City Council in January of 2022. There have been good results from this process, such as the remodeling of fire stations numbers 2 and 3. Having the report at the ready allowed the city to take advantage of federal grants. Federal ARPA dollars covered all of the costs for both of those fire stations, an example of city government at its best. The next facilities on the list for replacement are the police department and the offices of city administration. I'm not going to read you the list of deficiencies, but I will say it is long and worrisome, and I personally do not doubt that we need to address this. the current members of the City Council would like to address it, and if the public had the time to read and digest the information, most would agree it is past time to take action. But the public has not had the time, nor did they attend the single in-person open house that was held on the subject back in January of 2023. That is nearly 2 years ago. On the city's website, there is a picture of the audience at that open house. I count 30 people in that picture, 15 of whom are either city staff or members of the city council. That is very ineffective public outreach. And while the public remained underinformed, the city council got the hard sell. In October of 2023, at a work session, council was given a special presentation from the city manager, from Mary Steckel, and from two members of the architecture firm. At that meeting, they presented their pitch for a modern, shiny, new civic administration building to be built in place of the current city hall. To sweeten the deal and make it feel like a grand slam, at the very same meeting, special guests Sarah Architects were invited to present the first unveiling of the Obi Group's new hotel and residential building on Madison at the waterfront. Watching the meeting live at the time, over a year ago, I had the distinct sense of being in a car dealership and being pushed to give the luxury model a spin. It felt contrived to build momentum toward making a quick decision. Some members of the council appeared stunned by what they had seen, and some appeared excited. At that same meeting, discussion began about the need to inform the public about the civic campus concept. Next, in January of 2024, at a city council work session, the architects brought forward designs that included the addition of a new police department facility to the civic campus. And in February of 2024, the city council approved the formation of the Civic Campus Community Engagement Task Force. That task force had 6 months to engage community members, organizations, and businesses to raise awareness about the civic campus concept and to gather feedback about community values, goals, and the outcomes that the civic campus would achieve. I took that to mean that the feedback from the community would be used to help design the civic campus. I was wrong. During the same time that the task force was doing their work, the architects developed a total of 4 options for the civic campus. It's odd, but each of those 3 other options are more complicated and more expensive than the first option. None of the options presented was less expensive than the first. None of the options presented were created with the feedback from the community in mind. Instead, the feedback from the community has been used to either support or deny the desirability of each of the 4 designs. Fast forward to last week. At the work session meeting on Thursday, November 18th, the City Council took another step in the process of addressing our facility needs. While they held no formal vote, as votes take place on Monday night meetings, they spent a significant portion of time discussing the pros and cons of the 4 layouts of a civic campus on Madison Avenue between 5th and 6th Streets. There was one City Council member who asked for a 5th option, but the rest of the members present at the meeting expressed no concerns that the public input raised issues that the 4 options did not address. They disregarded feedback from the Civic Campus Community Engagement Task Force regarding separating the location of the police facility from the Civic Campus. In fact, at the end of the meeting, we finally heard from one of the co-chairs of the task force, Steve Clark. Had he been invited to a seat at the table during the meeting? Oh no, he signed up to give community comments at the end, and thankfully there was time to hear from him. He diplomatically stated that the city staff report to the council was insufficient in addressing some of the task force's findings, and noted that the creation of a civic campus should be one part of a larger discussion on addressing the needs of our downtown. He also noted that community members are deeply concerned with the cost of living in Corvallis, and that includes the cost of paying for this new facility. And there is that pesky point again, cost. At this time, we are looking at an additional $200 million of expenses to fund this civic campus. No one presented any option of how to go forward in a less expensive manner, or an option of paying for one building at a time. There was even apparent willingness on the part of some members of the council and the mayor to consider the additional cost of building a parking garage when we have had no proof that we need one. Let me stress that we do not have the budget to pay for these facilities and would be borrowing money to build them. And who will pay for that? You and I will, dear listeners. And what is more expensive than 2 new buildings? 3 new buildings, one of which being a $53 million parking garage that can store cars during the day and stand empty at night. This at the very same meeting where, just 1 hour earlier, the council was discussing how to cover a percentage of the city service fees for low-income residents. This in the city ranked highest in the state for rent-burdened households. This in a city that declined to help pay for insurance to cover managed camping for our unhoused community members. And who is one of the biggest proponents of asking us to pay for that parking structure? Our mayor. At approximately 1.5 hours into the meeting, the mayor said, "If I were king, we would go for the option of removal of City Hall and add parking." He did not seem to hesitate at the thought of adding that cost to the bill. And oh, the irony at the thought of borrowing millions of dollars to build a parking garage while we fight over nickels and dimes to improve transit, biking, walking, and rolling. And there is not one buffered or protected bike lane that traverses our downtown from north to south or east to west. This in a city that prides itself as bike-friendly, and this in a city that has been extolling the virtues of a walkable Madison Avenue corridor between campus and downtown. It's not too late. They have yet to vote. Have thoughts? Have opinions? Share them. There are only 4 council meetings left in this calendar year. On December 2nd, the council is going to vote on which of the 4 design choices to move forward to the next step in the design process. Current sentiment on council seems to favor the option of removing the current City Hall and building the new police facility at that location, and planning to build a new civic administration facility atop the current location of the municipal court building. Further in December, on December 16th, there will be a double whammy meeting. Due to the holiday season, the council is holding the final 2 meetings of the year on the same day. They will have their work session from 4 to 6 p.m. At that session, they will begin the discussion of how to pay for the civic campus. From 6 to 8 p.m. on Monday the 16th, they will hold the final Monday night meeting of the year. And I will be sure to tell you all about it. Okay, listeners, that's all I have for you this week. I'd like to express my gratitude at having the opportunity to speak with you about city politics and city government here on KORC's News, Music, and Civics. If you have comments or feedback, send me an email at wendy@korcfm.com. And if you have feedback for KORC's News, Music, and Civics, please email us at news@korcfm.com. Until next time, this is Wendy Byrne.
Thanks for joining us. This is KORC, News, Music, and Civics. And this is Dan Krall, joined by Trevor Held. We are standing next to the Marys River. Where exactly are we, Trevor?
We are about 2 or 3 river miles downriver from the town of Wren. So kind of in a valley that has no name, as far as I'm aware. But the road is Cardwell Hill Road, which goes by here.
We are on some land trust of sorts.
Crestmont Land Trust, I believe.
And it's a series of trails. Of course, we are by the Marys River, upstream from Corvallis by several miles. And Trevor here has canoed along this very channel.
It's really beautiful. There are some rapids, though, so be aware.
When was the last time you canoed the Marys River?
I don't think I got it out at all last year. So 2 years ago.
Really feels like, especially during the pandemic, our routines were disrupted in one way or the other. Some effects being positive, maybe spending more time outdoors, but negative effects like social isolation, loss of employment, time to contemplate and rethink life, which is really not easy for all of us to do. And nowadays, after the election, which admittedly was a shock to a lot of us. Have you changed your habits yet again, maybe regarding social media or time spent outdoors?
Yeah, around the time of the last election in 2020, I quit Facebook just because it was getting so horrible. People were just being so awful. And then this year, did the same with Reddit just because, holy cow. It's something about the addictive nature of it just really sucked me in for a long time, and I just wasted so much of my time just polluting my brain with all this horrible, horrible imagery and people being mean to each other. And I feel like I'm still recovering from COVID times. So yeah, anything I can do to decrease the flow of badness is a good thing to do.
Are you still on Reddit?
I'm not.
I am, and I absolutely relate to what you just said.
Yeah, there's so many things that I would love to be spending time on that I will hopefully now have time for.
I feel like since the election, I have tried to spend less time on Reddit because all of the news, it's like a really bad sci-fi horror film, political thriller, if you will, with various appointees. Of course, a lot of the pages I followed, people getting into fights, public freak out. As you said, it's a concentration of just seeing instance after instance of people being horrible to each other. And I feel like even watching fail videos, which I enjoy, my appetite for that was wet back in the days of America's Funniest Home Videos, back in the early 90s, which was kind of the early edition of fails. It was presented different. Now, fails being just video after video of people getting hurt or doing things incorrectly. You could watch expensive fails, sports-related fails. And it's just this constant reinforcement of negativity.
I don't know how to explain the attraction to it, but gotta get away.
It's good to mind our mental health. I guess that's the point I'm getting at. And being out in nature, being at places like this, it's good to have other material in which to digest and ponder and find joy, because if you focus on a lot of the aspects of life, whether it's your job, political elements on the national level that are out of our individual control, what seems to be like a world falling apart around us, I do feel like we, for the sake of our mental health, we do need to focus on community, strengthening friendships, having a beautiful natural spot in which to go, which there's no shortage of that where we live here in Corvallis. We are mere miles from wilderness. There are a lot of physical exercise opportunities within town. Trevor here is someone who I constantly see taking advantage of our bike lanes or outdoor recreation such as canoeing.
Yeah, I've tried to move away, but always am so homesick because there's just everything that I love is here. The rivers are, I can't even explain how amazing they are.
Their majesty is beyond words often. We are standing at the edge of the Marys River. This is Dan Krall with Trevor Held. And in a world where the news is heavy, and sometimes it doesn't seem like there's a lot of escape, we just wanted to remind you, take that time for yourself. Self-care is very important. I didn't grow up learning self-care. I've had to learn it in my later adult years, and I think an element of self-care is, even if just once in a while, getting away out to nature, a place where it's quiet, turning off the phone, putting your mental focus on something other than the problems of the world, whether it's your personal problems or our nation's problems, our state's problems. And I realize, not taking a lot of time for myself, that I feel very out of balance. So thanks to Trevor for suggesting that we come out to this Cardwell Hill area today. Just north of Wren, are we?
Yes, northeast of Wren. I'm having trouble with my ordinal and cardinal directions.
Would you like to continue our hike? We just took a little break, and I just wanted to take a little break here in the news show. We've got other presentations coming up this hour. But thanks for tuning in to KORC News, Music, and Civics, and thanks for telling your friends about this cool community radio station. Every once in a while, it's good to just make it out into nature. Before we sign off, Trevor, on that note, do you have any recommendations with the upcoming winter months where outdoor enthusiasts may seek some quiet time in the woods that aren't too far from town?
this place, Cardwell Hill Road, is one of my favorite little hikes just because you get the little treat of, well, the big treat of seeing the beautiful Mary's River, and it's very quiet. Also, McDonald Forest, these are all places you can bike to. If you want to be in town, I like Jackson Fraser. Certain times of year, you just get giant flocks of blackbirds that are all beeping at you.
Yes, the wooden boardwalk of the Jackson Fraser wetland. Kiger Island Road, if it's a dry day and you can actually go down the highway a little bit to Kiger Island Road, that is a great bike ride.
And Herbert Farm, also on Herbert Drive, south of Corvallis, is a good place to just get out in a big field. Actually, they planted an orchard there recently, so you don't get quite the same 360 horizon view that you used to, but it's still a good open space when you want to see, when you want to have a big sky.
Well, as we record this, the rain is picking up, and Trevor and I are going to continue on this hike in the Cardwell Hill area. Thanks for tuning in today, and remember to take care of yourselves and take care of each other. This is KORC News, Music, and Civics.
Hi, KORC listeners. This is JC, and today I'm interviewing Corvallis Housing First Director, Andrea Myrie. How are you doing today,
Hi.
Andrea?
I'm doing great, thanks
Good.
Very much for coming over.
Absolutely. We're so glad to speak with you today. My purpose in talking with you today is to learn more about Corvallis Housing First as an entity and also as a model. So what I learned from your incredible website, lots of great information. And I see on the website it says, from 2020 to 2022, Benton County point-in-time count, homeless individuals increased from 248 to 293, which was about a 40% increase for total number of people experiencing homelessness. And you're saying even on the website it might be likely higher than that.
Yeah, it probably is. The point-in-time count is just a one-night or a couple-of-night snapshot of homelessness in Corvallis. And so we count, not we, but it's a group effort. So the community counts how many people are in emergency shelters, as well as trying to go out on the street and count people that are in tents or RVs, things like that. So we don't capture, generally speaking, it's hard to capture everybody because a lot of people that are homeless are hidden. Although I would say I would commend our local street outreach team through the daytime drop-in center. I think they do a great job of reaching a lot of people who are experiencing homelessness and are living outside right now.
Gotcha. Okay.
So yeah, and it's gone up since then too. So it homelessness continues to increase in our community.
Okay. And do you see that as a kind of more just statewide and nationwide issue, maybe even global?
Well, for sure in our state. I think our state is facing an unprecedented crisis in homelessness right now. Oregon is a beautiful place. It's great, you know, for so many reasons. But one of the things that we have not done a good job with, well, actually we haven't done a good job with two things. So
okay.
One thing is we just lack housing across the board. We need housing and for people that are low income. We need housing for people that are middle income. And we just haven't done a good job of building enough housing, making sure that we have enough housing for people living in our state and the people that want to live here, too. So, you know, as people have moved into our state, we haven't been able to catch up with the housing stock that we need to house everybody. The other thing that's happening, too, is because of that scarcity, rents have gone up enormously. So we have, you know, just in Corvallis, we have the highest rent burden of any community in the state, meaning people spend more of their monthly income on rent than they should, than sustainable for them. Sometimes it's 50%, sometimes it's more than that, which makes it hard for low-income people to afford rent and food and all their basic needs. So that's really what we're seeing. People say homelessness is complicated. Well, it certainly is on the individual level. But in general, we are seeing people on the street because there's not enough housing for people. But the second thing that we have happening in our state is we are catching up with a long period of not investing enough in a behavioral health and addiction infrastructure. So we have a lack of types of treatment facilities and services for people with severe mental health issues, as well as people that are experiencing a substance use disorder. I would say that's a far second to the lack of housing, but it definitely contributes to the complexity of the things that we're seeing in the community that everybody is seeing. So it's right out in front of everybody, because if you're living on the street, it's like your living room is exposed to the world. And so that's what we're all seeing. So, yeah.
Okay. So it's a multi-layer issue, isn't it?
Right.
And I know the city of Corvallis, which is for a different conversation though.
Yeah.
The city of Corvallis is trying to address crisis and trying to address some of those substance use crisis and severe persistent mental health issues, for sure.
The other thing is, you know, with this crisis being unprecedented, we haven't had systems to work, you know, to address the issue. We still don't really have good systems to address
it. It's an influx. It's the number, sheer number, isn't it?
Yeah.
Okay.
It's the sheer number. And it's also, the city doesn't traditionally provide services. That's been on the county. Although the county isn't necessarily a provider of shelter or services that are for people that are experiencing homelessness, that's traditionally been maybe on the community action agencies, which are scattered throughout the state that provide assistance to people who are living in poverty. And so that's sort of their mandate. I would say for the most part, the state is really making a huge effort towards addressing homelessness throughout all of our communities. So there's a big push by the governor's office to fund shelters. So there was a huge increase in the number of beds during the pandemic and right after, trying to sustain those numbers of beds, and then also to try to create a better system to deal with the homelessness that we're seeing. The city and the county are doing their best to catch up to what needs to happen. I would say we're all just trying to figure it out. So there's been some progress, but more needs to be done for sure.
Okay, let me focus more on your agency, your organization. So could you tell our listeners about Corvallis Housing First? What are some of the services that your organization offers? What do you do?
Right. Yeah. So a little bit of history about us, and if your listeners have lived in town for a while, they might have remembered us as the Corvallis Homeless Shelter Coalition that was started with a group of folks led by Anita Haas Holcomb, who's been a longtime advocate and activist in the area of homelessness and mental health services in the community, but also Barbara Ross. She was a former state representative and super active in our community. She has since passed away, and we used to run the cold weather men's shelter, mostly with volunteers, very little paid staff. There was a huge, you know, kind of controversy in the community. I don't know, I guess it was like 8 or 9 years ago, about the location of shelter, how it was being operated. We have kind of a sketchy history in our community about supporting services and shelter for people experiencing homelessness. At that time, we decided that we would, seeing the same people in shelter every year, our board was frustrated with that and felt like really what our focus should be is trying to get people housed. And so at that time, we changed our name to Corvallis Housing First and started really focusing on trying to acquire more housing for people that have been homeless, and then also providing supportive services to those folks as well. So currently we have 40 units of housing in a variety of formats. So we have a fourplex, we have a single family home, we have a small apartment complex, we have a former sorority house that's located right in the middle of
right on
Greek
OSU.
Row, yes.
Yeah, like, right on OSU campus, isn't
yes,
it?
Right,
near.
Right, yeah.
Yeah.
which is funny because it seems to be a good fit for that.
Does it really?
Oh, yeah, it's great, actually. And that's more of an SRO, which means like there's single rooms in that house, and then there's shared spaces. So shared kitchen, bathrooms, living room area. And so we have 40 units mixed on all those different places. We also provide housing case management services, which means we have staff who work with all of the residents of those properties to make sure that we're helping them to meet their goals. We have more interaction with some people than others, but really just focusing on helping them, you know, fill out paperwork for benefits, anything from that to just being an ear, you know, like a friend, basically, because recovering from homelessness is really difficult. It's a huge crisis in someone's life, and it takes a while for someone to feel settled and to get their, to be able to feel stable enough to move on with their life, basically. We also work in partnership with Unity Shelter, so we have staff, which actually are a little bit limited right now because of funding, but traditionally we've worked within their shelters to help provide that housing case management to hopefully help people get into housing. We've been pretty successful at that.
That's Corvallis Housing First Director Andrea Myrie discussing the challenges that people experiencing homelessness are facing in Corvallis. Up next, she's going to talk about different services that are offered in Corvallis for people who need shelter.
Andrea, I didn't realize that Unity Shelter and Corvallis Housing First were separate entities or that you even partnered. Yeah. Could you tell our listeners a little bit more about that?
So in many communities across the country, there is a continuum of services for people that are experiencing homelessness. Typically how that looks is there's organizations. Sometimes it can be nonprofits, it can be local government, service providers. You need to address the issue on multiple fronts, and there are slightly different skills in each of these sort of buckets of services. So in our community, we have a drop-in center. So we have outreach, you know, folks that are going out on the street to talk to people, pass out basic needs like food supplies, hygiene supplies, things like that. Just getting and also developing a relationship with people that are experiencing homelessness. The Corvallis Daytime Drop-In Center, which is a separate organization, does a fantastic job of operating their drop-in center, and as well as being the organization that runs the street outreach team. So that's what they do. They do way more than that, actually, but that's...
it's one of many tasks that they do,
right? Yeah, it's they give people love. Like, that's pretty much... Right. That's their main thing. So Unity Shelter, which is a separate organization from Corvallis Housing First, as well as Community Outreach, Inc., so we work with them as well, provide shelter, transitional shelter housing. So you might have seen some of the micro shelters around in the community at different churches. That's a Unity Shelter program, and that's a transitional sort of shelter housing program.
So those houses that have been built near churches, particularly,
yes.
That's more of the Unity Shelter
folks.
That's
Unity Shelter folks, okay. Yeah. And so our partnership with them is we're housing first, we're housing focused, so we're trying to help some of those folks get, you know, apply for a Section 8 voucher, figure out income so that they can pay for rent, and then helping them find housing if they have a voucher or some way of paying for their housing, or sometimes linking them with other housing programs. And then whatever's associated with that, so helping people with disability paperwork or, you know, whatever they need. Unity Shelter also has some supportive services. They have traditional health workers to help people with health issues, and they do more too than that. But that's our partnership, and we have to absolutely work in partnership with these organizations. Fina Moses is another important partner. Because we all do something slightly different, but we don't replicate each other. And, you know, I can point out any client that we have gotten into housing. They haven't been just assisted by us. They might have started at Unity at a shelter site, or they might have started their journey towards housing at the drop-in center and received assistance from four or five agencies. When human beings are on the street, they need a lot of help. It's such a destabilizing thing in someone's life. They need a lot of assistance, and we don't provide. I mean, people talk about, you know, what about the safety net of, you know, government services? It's a net. There's a lot of holes in that net. We don't provide basic needs for people. We attempt to do that. We have, you know, food stamp programs. We have Section 8 rental subsidy programs. But, you know, for example, the wait list for Section 8 is years long for some folks. The utilization in our community is very low because our rents are so high. There's just a lot of gaps in services. And so we spend about, 70% of our time just navigating all the different systems of benefits and the services and helping people with that. It's a full-time job sometimes for folks to really maintain all the, their SNAP card and all this while trying to find housing or get a job or, whatever it might be. But
that really can be a full-time job for someone just to tap into all those resources and services, because like you say, they're so separate.
Right. Something that our, the county definitely has a role in this. So there's an Office of Homelessness Services through Benton County. It's not called that, but that's basically, okay, they're coordinating some of the funding as well as running some programming themselves so that they have a rental subsidy program that they've just started using state funds to help provide a gap coverage basically to people that are in need of housing immediately but don't have the Section 8 voucher or the income to pay for rent. And so that's been a really interesting program that they've started. So it's all a part of this continuum of services, as I said again, which is a really common best practice model that's used across the country. Another thing that our community is trying to do is to work on having a coordinated entry system where we have information on everybody that's experienced homelessness so that we can better coordinate services for them and get people into the appropriate housing that they need.
Like a common database, for example,
yes,
so that you can just look someone up and they don't have to start from scratch
right
at each. Gotcha.
That's exactly it.
Okay.
And it's been difficult because we are a part of a federal... there's the federal HUD program is called the Continuum of Care. And so our region, our HUD region, includes many, many counties in rural Oregon. So we are part of the balance of state Continuum of Care. There's, 25 or more counties in our Continuum of Care. Resources are stretched thin. Staffing, we just have a handful of staff helping us with this database and with our coordinated entry system. So it's been really difficult.
It's a big job.
It's a huge job.
Yeah.
And again, we haven't had this kind of crisis in the past. And so trying to make these systems work for this huge crisis has been tough. But
that's amazing. Thank you so much for informing our listeners about all these different services and how all of you work together. I understand that Corvallis Housing First has a new project going on. I'd love to hear about that. And so would our listeners, I think.
Yeah. So, again, our place in the continuum is housing focused. And specifically, what we're really trying to do is create more permanent supportive housing in the community. So permanent supportive housing, again, is a best practice model that's used across the country. People that have experienced chronic homelessness, they might have a disability, other things that make them vulnerable to being evicted or losing their housing. So the Third Street Commons project, which will be located where the Budget Inn is now. We haven't demolished it yet, but
right.
And to back up for just a minute,
sure.
So we purchased the Budget Inn with funding through the State of Oregon and Oregon Community Foundation called Project Turnkey. So during the pandemic, there was a need for non-congregate shelter beds. And then we had these terrible fires that happened, and so there we had all kinds of people that needed immediate housing and immediate just rooms to be in. And so the state decided to follow California's lead and to set up funds to purchase 20 plus, I can't remember the total number of hotels that were purchased through the program, but quite a number of hotels so that we could expand shelter basically for all these folks that are experiencing loss of housing due to fires, but also they needed safe places to be during the pandemic. So we were one of those sites. We purchased the Budget Inn. We opened it up in partnership with Unity Shelter as a non-congregate shelter. So we operated that site with them for over 3 years to serve people that were especially medically vulnerable. We tried to provide spaces for people of color. Oftentimes people of color who experience homelessness at a higher rate than white people do, feel uncomfortable in traditional congregate shelter settings, so it was a place for them to feel safe, and also taking a lot of medical or people that were in need of medical respite spaces, and that was in partnership with Samaritan Health Services. So you can see we all, like, all these relationships and partnerships are really
wonderful.
Important. And Unity did a great job in operating that shelter, and we served, I think it was over 170 people over the course of 3 years, and got a lot of people housed and provided a safe space for many people to take respite if they had a medical issue.
Wow, happening. I didn't realize you guys impacted that many lives. That's wonderful.
Yeah, it was such a great, and we would love to buy another hotel, but the program isn't funded right now.
That was Corvallis Housing First Director Andrea Myrie describing what had happened at the Budget Inn and how that was used to assist people who were experiencing homelessness during the pandemic. Next week, she'll discuss Third Street Commons and the plans that the city has going forward to support individuals with permanent supportive housing. You're listening to KORC News, Music, and Civics.
After a one-week strike that began November 13th, the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Workers Local 2064 has settled with Benton County. The union, which represents over 33,000 government workers in Oregon alone, and over 300 workers in Benton County, had been negotiating terms with the county since January. After negotiations came to a standstill in October, the workers voted to strike beginning Wednesday, November 13th. Strikes were held at three Corvallis locations, including the Calipoya Building, Avery Building, and Health Services Center. During the strike, Benton County decreased public service hours to 10 a.m. to 4 p.m. Strikers formed a picket line and chanted, "Hey, hey, look around, Corvallis is a union town," while intermittently receiving supporting honks from passing cars. According to AFSCME Council 75 Communications Director for Oregon, David Kreisman, after negotiations from the county stalled, quote, "I would say they put their fingers in their ear," unquote. He went on to say, "We're very close to settling, and the county is claiming we need to budget for 55 vacant positions. Some of them have been vacant, we think, for several years." The union's initiative to improve workplace safety was in part motivated by the death of Pete Newman, a Benton County employee who tragically died in 2019 when a faulty logging machine he was operating flipped over. "People should be able to come to work and feel safe and not be put at risk," Kreisman said. "I would really like to see that issue resolved. I think one of the challenges has been the complexity of the issues." The strike was officially ended November 20th when the local agreed to a new labor contract. However, the County Board of Supervisors will not vote on the settlement until their next meeting on December 3rd. If approved then, the contract will take effect immediately. Many strikers shared concerns about Corvallis' cost of living, which has become so expensive that some employees can't afford to live locally. Employees attested that they were brought in for meetings with management and questioned about the strike. According to the National Labor Relations Act, meetings of this nature are illegal. They're pulling people in for closed-door meetings, and it's their manager reading from a script asking if they're going to be striking today, said AFSCME program manager Kim Harmon. Harmon mentioned that falsehoods are being intentionally spread to hinder striking efforts, such as threats of fines or termination for blocking traffic. According to a press release from their website, AFSCME filed two complaints of unfair labor practices against the county in response to union-busting tactics. Workers affected served in behavioral health and public health clinics, financial services, records and elections, staff in the district attorney office, public works, and many other departments. During the strike, the county announced that services were still available, although many were curtailed or suspended. Law enforcement and justice services continued to be provided. The county still collected your taxes, of course, and Benton County and Benton Area Transit had no changes in schedule. County road maintenance worked only on an as-needed basis. The county clerk, was still performing required duties, but didn't accept applications for marriage or dog licenses or passports. Those things will have to wait. The fairgrounds and county parks remained open, but restrooms were closed. But now, county managers and supervisors have already welcomed back many employees to work. County Administrator Rachel McEnany joined the county's bargaining team more than a month ago so she could hear the union's concerns firsthand and lend her support to reaching consensus. Quote, "It took a tremendous amount of teamwork, problem-solving, and inclusive decision-making to come to this point," unquote, McEnany said. "This agreement includes creative solutions that will make us stronger as a county." The Benton County workers' strike is over. For KORC News, I'm Lava Lamp Larry.
Like a fly on the wall, at my own funeral, I am free. Like a fly on the wall, at my own funeral, I am free. Like a fly on the wall, at my own funeral, I am free.
The Southtown Art Walk is a grassroots event organized and led by artists in South Corvallis. The first annual Southtown Art Walk took place in 2011 when a small group of artists printed a map and invited family, friends, and the community to visit their studios for holiday shopping. The Southtown Art Walk has become an annual event, and it continues to grow each year as new artists join and existing artists share space at their studios for newcomers. The Southtown Art Walk aims to promote local makers and artists, build connections in the Southtown community, and celebrate shopping locally. It's the first Sunday in December, December 1st, from 10 a.m. to 4 p.m. There's more information at southtownartwalk.com. This is KORC.
You're listening to Cork News, Music, and Civics. The following is an excerpt from Democracy Now!, which aired on November 22, 2024. For more information on national and international news, visit democracynow.org.
UN Climate Summit in Baku, Azerbaijan, this is Democracy Now!
Trillions, not billions! Trillions, not billions! Trillions, not billions!
Climate justice activists are outraged at how little money is being offered here at this finance COP by the most polluting nations to countries most severely affected by climate change. Then to the International Criminal Court's historic decision to issue arrest warrants for the Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and former Defense Minister Yoav Gallant. Then to the so-called nonprofit killer bill that the U.S. House just passed. It could give the Trump administration sweeping power to revoke the tax-exempt status of any group, including media organizations. And we'll look at Trump's new pick for Attorney General Pam Bondi. As Florida Attorney General, she dropped a probe into Trump University after Trump donated $25,000 to her campaign. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. We're broadcasting from the UN Climate Summit in Baku, Azerbaijan. Azerbaijan's delegation to the COP29 United Nations Climate Summit has released the latest draft of a climate financing deal calling for the delivery of $1.3 trillion per year by 2035. But the text only calls on wealthier, more polluting countries to pay $250 billion per year to poorer nations bearing the brunt of the crisis. The group War on Want called the latest draft an insult, adding it's, quote, nowhere near the public grant-based climate finance the planet and people urgently need, unquote. In Gaza, Israel's deadly attacks are continuing a day after the ICC issued historic arrest warrants for the Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and former Defense Minister Yoav Gallant. In North Gaza, the beleaguered Kamel Adwan Hospital warns it'll turn into a mass grave if no medical supplies are allowed in, as it remains besieged and under attack from Israeli forces. In Gaza City, rescuers searched the rubble today after at least 20 Palestinians, including children, were killed in an Israeli airstrike on a building housing displaced families.
This building has been hit three times, and every time people were massacred. Most of it was gone. Nobody was left. All of them are martyred today. A whole family lays here. A whole family has been wiped away. I swear to God, the whole family is wiped from the civil registry because of you, Israel. You kill civilians.
In southern Lebanon, an Israeli air attack has killed another two paramedics, adding to the more than 220 health workers who've been killed by Israel in Lebanon. Separately, an airstrike in Beirut's southern suburbs leveled at least one massive building earlier today. Meanwhile, in the Netherlands, a coalition of rights groups are suing the Dutch government for providing arms to Israel and failing to prevent genocide in Gaza. President-elect Trump has named his former impeachment lawyer, former Florida Attorney General Pam Bondi, as his new pick for Attorney General Thursday after Matt Gaetz withdrew from consideration. At least four Republican senators adamantly opposed Gaetz' confirmation amidst a firestorm over sexual misconduct and trafficking allegations. As Florida's top prosecutor, Pam Bondi led a failed campaign to overturn the Affordable Care Act and fought to uphold Florida's ban on same-sex marriage. She now works with the right-wing think tank America First Policy Institute. The news outlet The Lever reports Pam Bondi's brother, Brad Bondi, has represented Elon Musk and Tesla against federal securities fraud charges. The U.S. House of Representatives on Thursday approved H.R. 9495, dubbed the nonprofit killer by civil society groups. The measure would give the incoming Trump administration broad authority to go after its critics by revoking the tax-exempt status of any group it labels a terrorist-supporting organization, with no evidence needed. The bill passed on a 219-184 vote, with 15 Democrats joining Republicans. H.R. 9495 has the support of the Anti-Defamation League and other Israel lobby groups. Critics warn the law would immediately target organizations fighting for Palestinian rights. The bill's fate in the Senate remains uncertain. Brazil's federal police force has recommended criminal charges against far-right former President Jair Bolsonaro for attempting a coup as he attempted to cling to power in the wake of the 2022 presidential election. The recommended charges against Bolsonaro, along with 36 former aides and cabinet members, came as CNN Brazil reported Bolsonaro had full knowledge of a plot to assassinate then-President-elect Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva. Five people, including a former advisor to Bolsonaro, were arrested over the alleged conspiracy this week. On Thursday, President Lula spoke publicly about the plot for the first time.
I can assure you that I am a man who has much more to be thankful for because I am alive. The attempt to poison me and Vice President Ackman did not work, and we are still here.
The Kremlin has denied claims by Ukraine that Russia used an intercontinental ballistic missile in an attack on the central Ukrainian city of Dnipro. On Thursday, Russian President Vladimir Putin said the attack had instead used a new type of intermediate-range hypersonic ballistic missile carrying non-nuclear payloads. The Kremlin called the strike a warning to the United States and United Kingdom for allowing Ukraine to fire U.S. and British-made missiles at targets deep inside Russia. In Pakistan, at least 42 people were killed and more than a dozen critically injured Thursday when gunmen opened fire on a convoy of 200 vehicles traveling through a remote northwestern region near the Afghan border. Witnesses say about 10 assailants appeared to target Shia Muslims, first attacking a police escort before firing indiscriminately on buses and cars. It's the latest in a series of deadly sectarian clashes between majority Sunnis and minority Shias in Pakistan's Khyber Pakhtunkhwa region that have killed dozens of people in recent months. Back in the United States, federal prosecutors in Brooklyn have indicted India's wealthiest man, Gautam Adani, and several associates on multiple counts of fraud under the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act, a U.S. anti-bribery law. Prosecutors accuse Adani of leading a $250 million bribery scheme in India to obtain solar energy contracts worth billions of dollars, then covered up the graft to raise money from U.S. and international investors. Adani, who's listed as the world's 19th richest person with a net worth of more than $85 billion, is a close ally of the Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi, who has repeatedly helped Adani Group win lucrative government contracts. Over 200 New Yorkers, including activists, union members, and elected leaders, gathered to call on New York Governor Kathy Hochul and the New York Power Authority to build 15 gigawatts of renewable energy. New York has proposed building just 3.5 gigawatts of renewable energy. This is Delorney Mamoran of South Bronx Unite.
2025 is coming, and the world is literally on fire. Brush fires everywhere. The Bronx has the highest brush fires in the past 2 weeks. And we have a Democratic governor and a Democratic majority in Albany. This is not the time to slow down on reforms. 15 gigawatts is possible.
New York City Assembly member and mayoral candidate Zoran Mamdani warned New York Governor Hochul is legally bound to fulfill New York's climate goals as laid out in the Build Public Renewables Act.
If you want to know how we can defeat the Donald Trump far-right movement, it's by showing that we actually have a workable alternative. Woo! Because if working class people can't breathe the air, if they can't afford to live in the city they call home because they can't find a union job, and if they look around at their favorite parts being on fire, why would they trust us?
In Kansas City, Missouri, community members are calling for accountability after a 34-year-old mother, Maria Pike, and her two-month-old daughter, Destiny Hope, were killed in an altercation with police where officers acknowledged they fired at least one shot. Their family members are demanding the release of body camera footage. And Palestinian-American poet Lena Khalaf Tufaha called on writers to use the power of words and their platforms to demand an end to genocide in Gaza as she accepted the National Book Award Wednesday for her poetry collection about Palestine called Something About Living.
I want us to feel and be uncomfortable and be disoriented and be angry and get up and demand that any administration, no matter what letter it has at the end of its name, D, R, whatever, that any administration that we pay for should stop funding and arming a genocide in Gaza.
And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman.
That was an excerpt from Democracy Now!, recorded on November 22nd, 2024. You're listening to Cork News, Music, and Civics. This is KORC.
When your car is making a strange noise, no matter what it is, you can't just pretend it's not happening.
That's an interesting sound.
It's like your mental health. If you're struggling and feeling overwhelmed, it's important to do something about it. It can be as simple as talking to someone in your community or just taking a deep, calming breath when you need it. Nice. For mental health resources, check out loveyourmindtoday.org. At loveyourmindtoday.org, you'll find information that may help you get through a tough time. Things like tips for dealing with stress, how to navigate difficulties like financial worries, anger, substance use, and more. You can also find real stories of how people navigated their own mental health challenges. Because once you start to address the problem, you can go so much further. Visit loveyourmindtoday.org. That's loveyourmindtoday.org. Brought to you by the Huntsman Mental Health Institute and the Ad Council.
Hey, this is Jackie from Philomath Fire and Rescue, your neighborhood firefighter, here with some fire safety tips. Thankfully, we live in an area where house fires are few and far between. Unfortunately, they do still happen, so it's best to be well prepared. When it comes to protecting yourself against fire, putting as many barriers between you and the fire can only help. So, when you go to sleep, make sure the door to your bedroom is closed before you doze. Closing your bedroom door can provide an extra 10 to 15 minutes to escape a fire in your home. So remember, close before you doze.